Blog Talk Radio.
The mooch is out. After 11 days, it is incredible. I realize that, but that's what happened. Moochie is no more. There's a lot of other stuff going on. But probably the most spectacular one is that Scaramucci is out. And it had to do with General Kelly. And it also had to do with some of the rude and obscene things that he said. His head has got to be spinning right now because he was in and out after 11 days. And the fact of the matter is that it doesn't get any more brief than that. So, as you know, John Kelly is in, as we mentioned, but I just find it so fascinating. I think this means that basically, and here it is from CNN. You gotta love the Schadenfreude. The Schadenfreude is a term that stands for the idea that you get pleasure out of your opponent's pain. And so, but also Scaramucci came in and he also attacked Rince Priebus, who seems like an honorable guy, and Priebus quit. So, I don't know what else to say, but here's a little clip for you.
And also standing by with a little bit more news.
CNN.
Scaramucci resignation after 11 days. Jim, what have you learned?
Well, the president was insisting earlier this morning on Twitter that there is no White House chaos. I think we now have further evidence that nothing could be further from the truth. There is obviously White House chaos when a communications director is only on the job for 11 days and then has to resign after a profanity laced tirade that dominated the news for part of last week. You have chaos here at the White House. Now, I was talking to a friend of Anthony Scaramucci just in the last couple of hours, who was insisting that he was going to weather this storm, and that that the story about him dog-cussing some of the people here at the White House, that all of that was going to pass. Obviously, that did not pass. And as Jeff and others were pointing out in the last several minutes, there was this issue that General Kelly was going to have to deal with as chief of staff as to what to do with these rival factions inside the White House. Anthony Scaramucci represented one of those factions inside the White House, and that is the former campaign people who did not very much like the RNC people who had come in to help run this White House, people like Rince Priebus, the former chief of staff, Sean Spicer, the former White House press secretary. Those two factions were among the factions fighting with each other inside this White House, and there was this question, and it was obviously going to come up at the briefing this afternoon, as to who reports to General Kelly. Do these rival factions inside the White House, people like Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner and so on, do they report to the chief of staff, or do they just report directly to the president and have the ability to go around the chief of staff? That is the exact situation that Rince Priebus was struggling to deal with when he was in charge, or not really in charge, when he was managing the staff here at the White House, is that he had people routinely going around him, walking right into the president's office and having meetings with him, sometimes meetings that Priebus did not even know about until later on. And mm-hmm. So this was one of the situations that General Kelly was going to have to deal with. Now, I do understand from talking to a source who is close to the president, and this is not exactly talking about the Scaramucci situation, but that this is a pattern that sometimes happens over here at the White House, is where something flares up. President says, well, no big deal, or he may even like that. And then later on, as he's getting feedback from other people, he sort of changes his mind and says, you know what, maybe this wasn't such a good thing. This person suggesting to me that perhaps that is what happened with Anthony Scaramucci here, whereas it may have felt cathartic to this president to see Scaramucci lashing out and going after some of these people who the president mm-hmm. wasn't very high on here in the administration. But then after time, after reflecting on it, perhaps didn't think too well of Scaramucci's performance over these last 11 days, Brooke.
Maybe this was a condition, as Gloria was saying. We don't know yet.
Well, I don't know everything, but I do know that there had to be a condition that General Kelly brought in, which was, I get control over everything. Everything comes through me. and I can get rid of people if I need to. Now, here is the mooch claiming he's going to get rid of the leakers. Now, if Rince Priebus was a leaker, he followed up on that. Check it out.
Some people think that we're naive, and when I've said I'm going to get rid of the leaks, I know I'm in a cesspool called Washington or a swamp called Washington, so it'll be virtually impossible to get rid of every leak, but I think we can take dramatic steps to get rid of leaks. Now, one of the big problems here that I'm discovering in the comms team is that senior people are really the guys doing the leaking, and they ask junior people to leak for them, and so I'm very proud to be reporting directly to the president so that I can hermetically seal off the comms team from this sort of nonsense.
This is so crazy. And, then the question is, would Scaramucci be out if he hadn't gone on the tirade, the obscene tirade against Rince Priebus? I think that a couple of things happened. Number one, even with Donald Trump, you can't have somebody that's getting up and cursing to reporters, number one. Number two, I think that his manner unhinged people, and he also communicated this idea that he was more in charge or he was more out there than the president. The president doesn't like that either. But the most interesting part of this is that he was escorted, according to reports, off of the White House property, if you can believe that. Now, here's a little bit from Charles Krauthammer, the hammer.
Rise and equally dramatic fall of Anthony Scaramucci. We're joined by author and columnist and keen observer of Washington, Charles Krauthammer. Charles, thanks a lot for coming on.
Pleasure to be here. Let me answer the last question.
Yeah.
Where's Scaramucci going? Obvious. Dancing with the Stars.
Now, I don't know anyone who's been on that show, but I would just recommend against it. Now, if he calls me, I'll tell him that. I think a lot of Republicans, a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump want to believe that this is a turning point where the energies of the administration will be focused outward and the debates that they're having will be policy debates, which, you know, and they can win some of them anyway. Do you think it is that?
I think it could be. I really do think if this is a successful presidency, which is possible, they will date it to this last week, which is where they hit rock bottom.
Yep.
And they got somebody in control, Kelly, who doesn't suffer fools. Obviously, his first edict was Scaramucci went way, way beyond the lines. It's not just a matter of chaos. It was sort of unseemly, both because of the infighting and because of the, quote, colorful language, unquote, and it couldn't be tolerated. And it appears as if he's going to establish lines of communication, lines of control that will all go through him, if that is so. And I would add one more caveat, that caveat is attainable. The second one may not be, which is if he can have some influence on reining in the president's own impulses, then I think they have a very good chance of succeeding. If they don't, if he can't do that, they will fail, and it'll be Trump 2.0, and it will go the way of Trump 1.0.
Well, there you have it. Here is a little dedication, a couple of dedicatory songs to the mooch, Anthony Scaramucci. Carole King, what a genius, huh? Her epic album, Tapestry. What's the old saying, in like a lion, out like a lamb? Anthony Scaramucci had the lifespan of a mayfly. From what I understand, that's not much beyond 24 hours. But he made his mark. And, I mean, I wonder if the guy, well, you know what? I think the guy is still considered to be a friend by the president, even though he was escorted off, because it seems like the president always stays friends with his former employees. And why wouldn't they be friends? Because Donald Trump really raised this guy up, and the guy made his own mistakes. They're calling this transition in the White House, which was absolutely necessary as far as I can tell. Rince Priebus wasn't doing the job. Now, it was inappropriate for the mooch to attack Priebus, because without Rince Priebus, then you don't have a Trump presidency, because he really, from what I understand, got the base moving in the various states that were needed to win. So that's all there is to it. All right, man, I've got a lot of, man, I've got 100 stories here for you. I'm trying to figure out, well, let me go to your headlines and get those out and do a little dredge report here. Australian Weather Bureau caught tampering with climate numbers. All right, so here's the real story about all of this AP or AGW. I think I was calling it anthropomorphic, and then somebody said anthropogenic, anthromangenic creation, global warming. All right, so you would think that all of the fear-mongering and all the claims, the hottest globe ever, 1 year after the next, is hotter and hotter. And you would think that that would be from people on the ground with thermometers, right? Machines and stuff. It's not. It's coming out of computer models. Always remember that. When you're dealing with global warming, you're dealing with computer models. And so the fact of the matter is, think about this. What if you were to be at, let's say you're a computer genius. I mean, I myself can barely know where the button to turn the computer on is, but that's me. So the person says, I want you to make me a program I want you to design a program which puts all of the facts of Earth into it. You know, a super encyclopedia of facts in this program, so that it represents every aspect of Earth, human society and stuff, you'd be understandably challenged and frustrated. So imagine doing that for weather. They want to put all the factors in for weather and then use that to predict. And what they found is it just doesn't work out. The computer models don't represent reality. And the reason that we know that is they're very bad at predicting the future. So, and also, think about this. Wouldn't it be, if you were a computer person, a scientist, and you were working on global warming and you knew in deep inside that global warming was killing everything, there'd be this almost irresistible impulse to tweak it a little bit, tweak the computer program? Well, that's essentially what the Australians did. And this is from Daily Caller. Australia Weather Bureau caught tampering with climate numbers. An Australian scientist at the Bureau of Meteorology, BOM, in Australia ordered a review of temperature recording instruments after the government agency was caught tampering with temperature logs in several locations. Officials admit that the problem with instruments recording low temperatures likely happened in several locations throughout Australia, but they refused to admit to manipulating temperature readings. The BOM located missing logs in Goulburn and Snow Mountains, both of which are in New South Wales. So, problem all throughout the global warming, in the history of global warming, the study of global warming, you've got a history of falsifying information. Now, in the defense of the scientists, they're just trying to get the facts, I guess, to represent what they consider to be reality. But they've got it upside down, don't they? Shouldn't you measure and then come up with your model instead of coming up with your model and making sure that the facts fit the model, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't that be the way to do it? So if you went in and Googled falsified global warming falsified information, you would find time after time the same thing, because the fact of the matter is the Earth is much more complicated than these people with these models will allow. So, I'm looking at this story on this little girl that was shot, which I had meant to mention yesterday, the little girl at the party. Wow, what a way to go. So let's take our, take a break a little bit early. Oh, I'm going to get back to your headlines. Kelly flexes, General Kelly flexes his muscles on his first day at the job, but more leaks are still coming. They got to get rid of the leakers. I mean, that's part of the problem. Rand Paul says Trump is studying executive action on health care. He needs to do that. Sean Hannity is executive producing faith-based movie. Sheriff Joe found guilty. Who cares, man? That guy's a hero. Man arrested twice in one day for naked strolls. He sounds like a committed naturist. Trump dictated son's misleading letter. Who cares? Germany tests facial recognition technology. Does that include with a towel on your head? Dozen inmates escape using peanut butter to trick jailer. I can't imagine what the trick was. 72-year-old lady kills 17 copperheads with shotgun, shovel, rake underneath her house, and she's just getting started. And USA detects highly unusual North Korean activity. So the economic numbers are all up. Let's take a break here and get your local weather. 627, here's the Scaramucci song, I Feel the Earth Move Under My Feet.
Oh, baby, when I see your face, mellow as the month of May. Oh, darling, I can't stand it when you look at me that way.
All right, so just to let you know, there's this site, Coco Ross. It's a community weather place. It's where you would put up a weather station at your own residence, and then it would be in communication with Coco Ross site. So anyway, I looked there this morning because we had a fair amount of rain last night, and there were some really heavy clouds that were passing through the area. And Coco Ross said 1.25 inches, so I don't know if that is the official amount, but that was kind of the summary for the last 24 hours. All right, so this young lady that was killed, shot, Jocelyn Trujillo Pierce, weeks away from starting her freshman class, and 14 years old, was at a party, gotten out of juvenile custody, and was inside of a house when these two brothers came, or inside of an apartment, I think, when these two brothers came up, who had been kicked out of the party, and they just shot randomly, and the shot went through and hit her in the back of the head, and she died. So it's pretty sad, but I mean, you know, it's just it sounds like a rap song, doesn't it? I'm sure these idiots listen to rap, but I mean, you can read through all the details, but she had the article in the Sun News said that by Carlos Andres Lopez said that she had, and that was published yesterday, that she had lost both of her parents at a young age. So perhaps it's not surprising that she struggled a little bit in life. Anyway, these brothers were involved in this, but I don't know. What do you think should be done? I mean, I guess, you know, these a person who just kind of shoots randomly into a dwelling, I mean, that person's an animal, you know? And society should be protected from them. I don't know what else you can say besides that. One brother's name Gutierrez, and the other one's, or Barrera, the other one's called, named Gutierrez Barrera. I assume they have two different dads, but it's just incredible. You shoot through somebody's house and hit somebody in the back of their head, and that person just, you know, dead as a doornail. And I'll be interested to see if they invoke the felony murder rule. That charges in that, I mean, I've never heard it charged in this town, but depraved heart murder is where somebody does something that is so reckless or crazy that it was quite likely that a bad event would occur, like shooting a gun through a building and not knowing who was on the other side. So, but I'll be interested. The felony murder rule is if they're, during a crime, someone commits an act that leads to murder, either directly or indirectly, go to a gas station, the clerk is shot, then dies, then everybody in the, that's part of the crime gets charged with murder, in theory. If you rob a bank and the teller has a heart attack and dies, you can be charged with murder. So, anyway, all right, so 4 your next story here, still kind of looking at this situation, but all right. So some Google headlines for you. Well, you know, things are still degenerating in Venezuela. See anything that big right now. Let me get to your, speaking of which, let me get to your weather. And as they say, a lot of rain coming, hopefully. 523-1450 to call in. And the new phone, I told you I lost my phone. Then I found the phone, but it was too late because I'd already gotten another phone. Then I broke the new phone. That was within 5 days, I think. And then I found out how expensive it is if you have insurance on your phone to replace it. It was incredible. So now I switched my, just briefly, momentarily switched the phone that I use for the text on this show to my main phone. So you can't get through to me. But 523-1450, we'll be back at 637. We've got some local weather. Scaramucci, yeah, baby, you're gone. Poor little Scaramucci. There's supposedly record heat coming this way. I don't really know if there's anything to that, of course, but I thought it was interesting. And I've got a little clip here, if I can get it to open. Although it's from the Weather Channel. I don't even know if it is coming here. I just know that it's coming to the west, so maybe it is not. But the map that they showed had it, picture of it, kind of going through here. So, yeah, I have a little clip from Scott Adams on why the president might be doing what he's doing to Jeff Sessions, embarrassing him. And Scott Adams is the guy that does Dilbert, and he had called for a Trump presidency. And so he's a very successful guy, very smart guy, and he said Trump was going to win, and he was right. So anyway, here's this heat warning.
Outdoor activity in now. Portland, you are going to heat up where you could actually surpass or reach your all-time hottest temperature, which is 107. That's coming later this week. We're in the midst of a historical heat wave out in the Pacific Northwest. 116, that's your forecast high today in Redding, California. Boy, is it going to get hot with a lot of these cities. Pretty much every one of them on the map is over 100 degrees by tomorrow. Now, the worst of this heat wave will be Wednesday through Friday, and then it will start to ease. But here are some of the cities across the Northwest where we could see those records broken.
Eugene, Oregon, my old stomping grounds, 108. And but the heat wave is supposed to go through here, but it seems pretty temperate right now, considering it's the middle of the summer. All right, here is something from Scott Adams. Get this stupid thing to play. I'm having speed issues on my computer. And let's see here. I've got fallback stories here, of course. Sweden welcomed returning ISIS fighters and gave them new identities. You want to know why the West is struggling? It's because of crap like that. You've got people who are idiots, who don't know anything, who are supporting things that are just detrimental to human life. And, you know, typical liberal, half-formed or totally uninformed people that are, they're going to kill us, you know? I mean, what I understand wanting to be sympathetic to the little guy or whatever you want to call that, but that's just stupid. A group of people who are committed to the demise of the West, and you're going to help them come into your country by giving, after they fought in jihad, you're going to help them by giving them a new identity. Are you kidding? I mean, it's just so stupid. All right, I'm looking for this. I got a little bit of this clip. I don't know. Go back to my original clip and see if this thing is cooperating at all. It's not, of course. Well, let's just see what this has in it. Scott Adams is an entertaining guy no matter what, so check it out. Dilbert creator saying there's a reason that he's going after Jeff Sessions because it's the only way to get him to do what Trump wants. It's a picture of this guy's house with a cat on a couch.
Hey, everybody, come on in. This is Boo the Cat. I've been thinking about taking a nap, but I decided I needed to talk to you guys instead.
That's what happened when you hang around cats. You feel like sleeping.
Try to clear up this whole Jeff Sessions stuff. I know you're all you're all dying to find out what's going on here. That's right, no naps. Sleep is for the dead. Did you just blaze? No, I didn't. Just came back from the gym.
All right, I can't take any more of this. So I'll have to go back and find the spot where it's at. But I do, you know, I have something that you may find entertaining. I got a lot of stories last night. I spent hours listening to stories about Kim Jong-un, since he's supposed to be the person we're going to war with. Check this out. Kim Jong-un executes defense chief with anti-aircraft guns. That's the leader of North Korea, in case you've been living under a rock.
In Kim Jong-un's workers' utopia, General Hyun Yong-chol stood right at the front. Yet the four-star general and minister of defense has been wiped from the face of the earth. The revelation, squirreled out of North Korea by the South Korean intelligence agency, who had something surprising to add. General Hyun was apparently killed or pulverized by anti-aircraft fire. He was filmed last month in Russia, deputizing for his leader at a security conference, and he sounded every bit the loyal minister. "We won't change our nuclear weapons strategy," he said, "not for millions of dollars," before leaving to to mild applause. It's not exactly clear why Kim Jong-un decided to eliminate the country's number two military official, but the South Koreans say it's about respect. The general hadn't followed instructions. And secondly, in a disclosure that received plenty of airtime on South Korean TV today, General Heon may have fallen asleep at a meeting.
This kind of purging has gone on since the very start of North Korea with Kim Il-sung, who was Kim Jong-un's grandfather. It has two roles, really. One is, of course, to keep everyone scared, to keep everyone worried and paranoid. And the other is to nip any nascent challenge to the regime in the bud very, very quickly.
And it's a policy that Kim Jong-un has deployed with real enthusiasm. He's disposed of 70 officials since he took power in 2011, surprising critics with his absolute ruthlessness. Mr. Kim's victims include his uncle and mentor, Jang Song-taek, who was arrested 18 months ago at a party meeting. Uncle Jang was accused of counter-revolutionary activities and executed, probably by a firing squad. General Hyun's departure, brought about by much larger weapons, it seems, with a human rights group suggesting the regime was carrying out executions by anti-aircraft guns back in October. Using satellite photos, they pinpointed the Russian-made weapons lined up on a rifle range. By eliminating the general, the country's 30-something dictator sends a message to his would-be challengers, but it's also an admission of his vulnerability at the top.
Interesting, huh? Anti-aircraft gun has four guns as part of its barrage, so it is unbelievable. All right, so let's take that last break here, 523-1450 to call in. We'll be right back. All right, so the situation explained here by Scott Adams, what's going on, in his opinion, with Jeff Sessions.
So here's the question I wanted to ask you. So I'm seeing a lot of criticism about President Trump's treatment of Jeff Sessions. And in the criticism, people say, well, why didn't he handle it a different way? And so here's the question I'm tossing around in my mind. People who are criticizing the president, they probably know that if you talk to Jeff Sessions personally, you know, privately, and said, here are my private grievances, that in all likelihood, Jeff Sessions would say, oh, I totally know what you want, but here are the reasons I recuse myself. Here are the reasons I'm looking into these things and not these things. And, you know, this is the way I'm going to do it. So I have a feeling that talking to Jeff Sessions privately either has already happened through channels. You know, in other words, there may have been communication. It just wasn't sitting in the same room. But I have a feeling it would have made no difference. And the president probably knew that. Now, people say, oh, but he could just fire Jeff Sessions if he doesn't like what he's doing. But almost in the same breath, people like Lindsey Graham say, if he fires Sessions, there'll be hell to pay and the whole government could come down. So here's what his critics know. He couldn't talk to him in person and really expect anything to change, because it wasn't as if Jeff Sessions didn't know what President Trump wanted. There was no lack of knowledge about what was good for the president or bad for the president. There was no lack of knowledge of what the president's priorities were and what things he cared about, what things were affecting his presidency. There was nothing to tell him. And apparently Jeff Sessions had decided that the way he's playing it makes sense based on And here I'll be as charitable as I can. Jeff Sessions knows more about all of these situations than we do. So probably he thought about it. He looked at all the facts. He said, I'm handling them exactly the way I've decided to handle them, and this is the best way. So he couldn't talk to him in person and really expect anything to change, and he couldn't fire him because the government would just go into revolt and so would the people. But he still needed him to do something differently. So what was his third option other than surrender? Right. If there's one thing that you noticed this week, there's one big shift, and I don't know if all of you saw it. The big shift this week, last several days, especially with Scaramucci, is that the president has gone on offense. So he's sort of been on defense on all of this Russia stuff, and he's been getting kicked around for a little bit. And it's just obvious he decided to go on offense.
All right, so that's the explanation there. And speaking of big shifts, here's Schiff's Riffs with the big questions of life.
Hi there. This is Mark Schiff of Schiff's Riffs. And today I want to talk to you about the big questions in life. You know, who am I? What am I? What am I about? What am I looking for? Where am I going? These are huge questions in life. Socrates, he was famous for saying, for everything I know nothing. Now, Socrates can talk about himself like that, but good old Sock, he was a big pain in the neck, and he went around asking other people, telling other people that they knew nothing. They hated him for it. He would walk up to people and go, you think I know nothing? You know even less. Eventually, they gave him some hemlock and poisoned him. I came from a very Socratic family. They would ask the big questions. My mother would ask me questions like, what do you think the way you think? This is a huge question, especially for a five-year-old. This is gigantic. How do I know? You know, I realized one day, even at a tender age, that if I didn't want my mother to ask me these questions, all I had to do was answer her. So she would say, why do you think the way you think? And I said, I think the way I think because I am who I am, and I think who I am is who I am, even if you think I'm not that person. My mother knew she was living with a lunatic at that point, and she didn't bother me anymore. My mother would ask me questions of herself, but not the gigantic questions. She loved hot coffee and cookies. She used to dip the cookie in the coffee, and the cookie would just fall apart in the hot coffee, and she would ask one of the biggest questions you can ask in life. Why does the cookie crumble? This is a gigantic, this is an unbelievable question. She never figured that answer to that question in life. She died like a lot of people, unrealized, without the big answers in life. My mother also would ask other questions like, how come I always took an umbrella with me, it never rained? How come when I went to the dentist with a toothache, when he called me in, the pain was gone? These are big questions she also never got the answer for. My father would ask questions of my mother. Why does she act this way? How come she always has a headache? He also died before I ever getting any of these answers. My teachers would ask questions. Why do you kids act the way you act? Why do I put up with this? She had a stroke before getting any of those answers. It's unbelievable. My old girlfriends would ask questions of me like, what did I ever see in you? What did I ever see in you? This is a gigantic question. If you can figure this one out, you can go on to have a great relationship. They never did. They got in trouble with 50, 60 other relationships down the pipe. That's just the way it is. You got to be able to know who you are, when you are, and what you're doing in life. The important thing in life is not necessarily just the big, big questions, but to know you're a good person. That's what's really important. Like, for instance, if you have a dog, does your dog love you? If he does, if she does, then you're a good person. If you come home and you have a bird, and every time the bird sees you, he whistles and sings, then you're probably a good person. If you walk into a store in your neighborhood and people are happy to see you because you're a great customer and a good person, then you're a good person. This is what's important. So this is Mark Schiff.
All right, Schiff's Riffs there. Take you out with some Carole King, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. Be back. All right, well, we did cover a few things last hour, including the mania, the craziness of the fat little kid, Kim Jong-un. And that could be our new partner in war. And somebody asked me, came up and asked me yesterday if I believed in preemptive wars, preemptive strikes. And I said, yeah, sometimes. And the person said, well, what should we do in North Korea? What do you guys think we should do? 5-2-3-14-50. I mean, these guys have nuclear weapons and the leader is crazy. So I think that, you know, you've got to avoid at all costs setting off a war because there's going to be a lot of people killed and there's going to be a lot of nuclear pollution and it could draw China and or Russia into a conflict. So, I mean, I don't know what else you can say about that. A war with that, those people would be catastrophic, and it would especially be catastrophic for them, but I don't know what else you're going to do. In the meantime, there is said to be a spiritual awakening at the White House. Remember, I had told you there were claims out there that the president had had he'd had an epiphany or he'd had a moment of enlightenment where he became a Christian, or that's the claim anyway. And this is from CBN News. Bible studies at the White House, who's inside the spiritual awakening. Check this out.
When it comes to where they stand on God and the Bible.
These are godly individuals that God has risen to a position of prominence in our culture.
All handpicked by President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence.
I don't think Donald Trump's figured out that he chained himself to the Apostle Paul.
Ralph Droellinger is a former NBA-playing giant of a man with an even bigger calling. He founded Capital Ministries with the idea that if you change the hearts of lawmakers, then their Christian worldview will guide them to make good policies. He started Bible studies in 40 state capitals, teaches weekly studies in the U.S. House and Senate, and now leads about a dozen members of President Trump's cabinet in weekly studies of the Bible. Health Secretary Tom Price, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, and CIA Director Mike Pompeo are just a few of the regulars.
It's the best Bible study I've ever taught in my life. They are so noble. They're so learned.
Has this been done before in a cabinet formally?
I don't think there's been a cabinet Bible study in America in at least 100 years.
America's top cop, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, also attends.
Like Jeff Sessions, he'll go out the same day I teach him something, I'll see him do it on camera. And I just think, man, these guys are faithful, available, and teachable, and they're at Bible study every week they're in town.
President Trump is invited to attend the Bible studies, too. Each week he receives a copy of teachings, and when he can, Vice President Mike Pence will join the study. In Pence, Droellinger sees similarities to Joseph, Mordecai, and Daniel from the Bible, all men who rose to the number two position in government at different times in history.
Mike Pence has respect for the office. He dresses right, like it says Joseph, you know, cleaned himself up before he went to stand before the Pharaoh. Mike Pence has uncompromising biblical tenacity. And yet a loving tone about him that's not just a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And then fourthly, he brings real value to the head of the nation.
Like others, Droellinger often compares President Trump to biblical strongman Samson.
I just praise God for them, and I praise God for Mike Pence, who I think, with Donald Trump, chose great people to lead our nation.
Jennifer Wishon, CBN News, the White House.
All right, so I thought you might find that kind of an interesting story. So a couple of other articles in the same group. Faith leaders pray for Trump at Oval Office, enjoy an open door at the White House. So they don't have an official office, but there's supposedly a lot of opportunity for the evangelicals to be involved. And Trump said also that he was highly enthusiastic about evangelicals. I think the evangelicals voted for Trump by a margin of 80%. So who knows what's going on behind the scenes there. But, you know, it's got to be an extremely pressure-packed situation. And, all right, so they're saying that Venezuela is heading towards civil war, which is certainly sad to hear. A country with so much promise, and the government has completely let them down because the ideas in the government are so mistaken. And you've got this country which has more oil reserves than any country on the face of the earth is now looking like it could go into total chaos. And, you know, somebody was called up, as you recall yesterday, I think it was Aaron, to say that we should send weapons over there. I don't know what you feel about that, but I do have a couple of little clips for you here just to keep you posted. But I do think it's fascinating that the ideas that the people in the left in America want are put into practice. And when they're put into practice, it's a total catastrophe, and it's always the same way, and the left never bothers to even try to explain it because they just say, well, that's not the leftism I believe in, as if there's more than one leftism, but there's really not. It all leads to tyranny. And here is a little bit from Maduro claiming victory at the polls.
Several people have been killed in clashes in Venezuela during the country's controversial election. President Nicolas Maduro has claimed victory, calling it the biggest vote ever for the revolution. He wants to put in place a new constituent assembly with powers to rewrite the constitution. The opposition boycotted the vote, and at least 10 people died in clashes between police and protesters. Well, our correspondent Will Grant is in the capital, Caracas, for us now. And Will, the election appears only to have added to Venezuela's problems.
That's right, Rita. This was the bloodiest election day in living memory, really, in Venezuela. And as you say, it's completely compounded existing problems. The governments say that around 41.5% of the electorate turned out to vote for them. And they're taking that as a resounding victory. But most Venezuelans, I think, watched in disbelief when that result was announced. They simply don't believe that many people turned out in support of the government, given the disillusionment, the anger, the frustration on the streets, the long queues for basic foods and the violence. Mr. Maduro now has a serious problem on his hands in terms of the credibility of this vote and of governing Venezuela moving forward.
Will, thank you.
And one more clip here about the deadly riots that came out of the election.
Other nations have condemned Venezuela's election, calling it a sham and a threat to democracy. At least 10 people were killed in violent clashes between protesters and police yesterday. It's the latest wave of unrest to sweep the country. Sunday's vote gives Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his Socialist Party full control of the assembly. They have the power to rewrite the constitution and eliminate the opposition-controlled Congress. Manuel Bojorquez is there.
Police and protesters battled, as they have for months, in the streets of Venezuela. Demonstrators believe the election continues to hurtle the country toward dictatorship, with President Nicolas Maduro and his Socialist Party at the helm.
What do you say about this election?
Fraude constitutional, completamente.
Constitutional fraud.
Protesters like Juan Carlos Gutierrez say they were threatened with 10 years in jail if caught marching the streets.
We have a little piece of democracy, and the government is killing us at all.
By rewriting the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Voting sites sat largely empty across the country, as many Venezuelans who favor the opposition stayed away from the polls. Others, like Ivan Nava, took to the streets instead, even as gunfire was heard nearby.
They're shooting right now. Crazy, man. We're living in a dictatorship right now.
The national police were targets, too. This explosion injured seven officers on motorcycles. Maduro supporters called the protesters terrorists.
So you want some law and order, peace, paz, is lo que quieres. That's what you want.
Paz.
Falling oil prices coupled with skyrocketing inflation have crippled Venezuela's economy. Oil accounts for nearly half of the government's revenue. And Venezuela is the third largest supplier of oil to the U.S., which buys about a third of the country's crude.
Why are you out here today?
Young Venezuelans like Diana Osuna say they just want their voices heard.
You feel like you don't have what you want, what you deserve.
That, what's that?
That liberty, what you want to do, what you really want to do.
Freedom.
Yeah.
You don't
Freedom.
Feel you have it.
No, we don't.
CBS News national correspondent Manuel Bojorquez is with me now from Caracas. Manny, what has the reaction been on the ground there from the people of Venezuela?
Well, clearly you've seen it, and it was expected. A lot of protests, much of it turning violent when they clashed with the national police. You have people who have said all along, one, we're not participating in this vote that we feel is a sham, but two, that they would not legitimize the outcome of the vote. We're expected to hear more about that today from the opposition, which is also, as you know, debating the number that the government has put out here of 8 million Venezuelans voting for this assembly, saying it's actually less than 3 million from what they can tell. So the turmoil and the debate here certainly continuing today.
Manny, talk to us a little bit about how this election will directly impact their lives on a daily basis.
Well, as you've heard, many people feel that this will bring this country closer to a Cuban-style one-party system. That is something that they do not want to see. They feel that already the president here has eroded many of the democratic institutions of the country. But you also have the financial situation here, already a very difficult one for many people when it comes to jobs, finding food, finding medicine. If the U.S. and other countries impose more and significant sanctions on Venezuela, especially when it comes to oil output, that only stands to further weaken the economy here, and that is something that people clearly are very concerned about.
How about the opposition party in the government? How do they plan to fight this election?
Well, we plan to speak with more of those opposition leaders today about what they plan to do at this point. Many of them had feared that this rewriting of the Constitution would only consolidate power for the president and give him more ability to detain or imprison many people who simply want to voice an opposing voice. So at this point, what we do know is they plan to continue with marches and to organize the opposition. What they can do politically, though, that remains to be seen as the Constitution has yet to be rewritten.
Does that mean we could see more violence on the streets?
Absolutely. And of course, that is the big fear here, that as many people rise to protest this vote, the outcome, and the continuing moves by the Maduro administration, that you will continue to see these outbursts in the streets of Caracas that we saw yesterday. What happens in many of these is you do have people who are marching or peacefully protesting, but if they so much as block a road or enter into an area where they are not wanted by the national police, then those clashes happen first with tear gas and then with deadly force if deemed necessary. And of course, you see on the other side where the national police is saying that people use improvised explosive devices to harm them. So that is the fear, that you will see more of that. And
obviously, civil war is possible. Okay, we'll take a break for a little bit here and come right back a little further. Dedication to Scaramucci, which is sad but true. Too late, little Scaramucci. We'll be right back. 523-1450, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of of us is changing, or maybe we just stop trying.
All right, so story here, Swedish government took 150 ISIS jihadists and protected them, changing their identity so people wouldn't find out that they were fighting in jihad. In the meantime, they're deporting Christians to Muslim nations where they face prison, torture, and death. And one of the reasons they're changing the names of the ISIS fighters is so they don't have a hard time finding a job. But, I mean, why would you take people who are totally and radically opposed to your way of life and bring them into your country and give them new IDs so that they can't be detected? Meanwhile, deporting the individuals who essentially agree with you on most, or if not all, important issues. Why would you do that? In my opinion, you do that because you don't care about the future and you're so caught up in political correctness and multiculturalism that you're just living, and you want people to know that you want people to know, and they found this to be consistent from people on the far left, is that they're very, very caught up in the idea of being recognized as being cutting edge and, you know, human rights superstars and this type of thing. And they obviously don't use common sense. They don't use common sense because they don't make decisions that are in their best interest or the best interests of their people. So it's a suicide movement within this. And so Megyn Kelly, who became famous for going after Donald Trump, and this was the beginning of the end. I didn't even think it would come to this. I thought she'd stay at Fox News and, you know, maybe lose a little bit of a reputation with Trump supporters. But Megyn Kelly she made a ton of money, but she's made a disastrous career decision. And this is from Red State yesterday. And it starts off, if you were planning to tune into Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly next Sunday, there's a good chance the show won't be on, and there's a good chance the show will never be on again, with NBC reportedly pulling it from the lineup following a ratings implosion, a nosedive, a collapse. It was originally set up for a 10-week summer run and was supposed to return Sunday night following the NFL season and the Winter Olympics, but now they're setting her up for a morning show called Megyn Kelly Today, but her popularity has dropped with her base, which had been conservatives. And going after Trump and trying to embarrass him, and basically all of these arrogant news people, these anchors, were caught up in this battle to be the first one, to be the one to destroy Trump. They were going to put a scalp on their wall, and it backfired on them. And now a number of the people who've gone after Trump have seen their own standing fall. And, you know, does Megyn Kelly even have a career left? I mean, I know that she's going to be working at NBC, but just really ill-advised people who were very arrogant and thought that the media was the greatest source of power and truth in the history of America, and were willing to go after and destroy. They thought that they were going to destroy Trump, and they themselves were destroyed because the power, it's not Trump himself, although he's a very cagey person. It's because there were so many people that were upset at the direction of the country and the arrogance of the elites. Now here's a little bit from CNN's Fareed Zakaria. A Trump victory, an act of class rebellion against the educated. And really, I don't consider these people educated, because the main result of a education is supposed to be able to allow to teach people how to think independently, and these people can't do that.
Fareed, I'm really looking forward to your special, your documentary that will air later tonight, premiere later tonight here on CNN about the 2016 presidential election. It's entitled Why Trump Won. Tell our viewers here in the United States and around the world the focus of your documentary, the message.
Well, we really tried to ask Wolf was not even why he won, but why he even came close, because everybody has their own pet theories. Well, it was Hillary was a weak candidate, the Comey letter, Russia. But really, the bigger question is, this is the most unorthodox presidential candidate, really. Why did he even win the nomination against 16 very talented politicians? Why did he come close when he made so many statements, gaffes, mistakes that would have blown up the candidacy of anybody? There must have been something there that was deeper. And we tried to get at that deeper issue, which is really a portrait of America, a kind of cultural and class portrait of an America that feels deeply resentful about the direction the country is going in, and the people who run the country, people, you know, who are professionals, urban, educated. This is, in a sense, an act of class rebellion. It is an act of cultural rebellion. And Donald Trump is their guy. You can ask, we try to explain why he became their guy. But he is their guy, and you know, my sense has always been they have latched onto him the way you latch onto a sports team. The fact that the sports team is not doing well does not mean you will give up support. So when people keep watching and saying, well, but Trump is not really a conservative, ideology doesn't matter. They say, well, he's not accomplishing much. Competence doesn't matter. This is some kind of tribal identity, and they're sticking with him.
And they certainly are. That base, clearly, at least most of that base is very much with him right now. Fareed Zakaria.
The fact of the matter is that people have seen that the elites don't have answers, and they're bailing on it, and they know that Trump represents a direction away from the elites, and they don't want to be around this leftism, which is personally reprehensible to them because it contains within it so many doctrines that they dispose to. And it doesn't work. So we, you know, Fareed Zakaria can get up there and say the president is incompetent. I'd like to see how competent he was if he didn't have all these parasites and these little chihuahuas chewing on him. 7:31. Here's your local news. 5:23:14:50. Dedication to Scaramucci. All right, so I've got some for you here. I've got a little bit of Jordan Peterson. People have been reacting well to this. And how about a little bit on why globalism fails and nationalism is relatable? So we've got a trend in the world from the elites, the people that always fail, that we need to go into globalism, which means international decision-making. And ownership. Well, maybe not ownership, but international control of resources. It's the globalist position that the resources are finite. It is the nationalist's position that it should be the nationalist position that resources are infinite or at least semi-infinite given the right technology. You go in, you find an oil field, you pump it dry, and then years later, a new technology comes along that allows more oil to come out, because really in a lot of these big oil fields, you may only get 5 or 10% out of the ground and the rest is stuck in there. So you can keep going back with different technology, but it's not a question of wasting stuff. It is a question of how do we maximize our life on Earth? And it's not through globalism, because it's international socialism. It's the great dream of Marxism to begin with. And it's tyranny. You can see it everywhere. It's tyranny. All right, here's Jordan. Globalism fails, nationalism relatable.
in 2008 when the politicians said, too big to fail, they got something truly backwards, as far as I can tell. And that was, it was a reverse, the statement was reversed. It should have been so big it had to fail. And that's what I think the story of the Tower of Babel is about. It's a warning against the expansion of a system until it encompasses everything. It's a warning against totalitarian presumption. So what happens, for example, when people set out to build the Tower of Babel is they want to build a structure that reaches to heaven, right? So the idea is that it can replace the role of God. It's something like that. It can erase the distinction between earth and heaven. And so there's a utopian kind of vision there as well, as we can build a structure that's so large and encompassing that it can replace heaven itself. And that's an interesting, the fact that that doesn't work and that God objects to it is also extraordinarily interesting. And it's an indication to me of the unbelievable profundity of these stories. It's like, I think one thing we should have learned from the 20th century, but of course didn't, was that there's something extraordinarily dangerous about totalitarian utopian visions. That's something Dostoevsky wrote about, by the way, in his great book, Notes from Underground, because Dostoevsky had figured out by the early 1900s that there was something very, very pathological about a utopian vision of perfection, that it was profoundly anti-human. In Notes from Underground, he demolishes the notion of utopia. One of the things he says that I loved, it's so brilliant, he said, imagine that you brought the socialist utopia into being. And Dostoevsky says, and that human beings had
Kelly.
Nothing to do except...
Kelly?
Yeah, hey, who's this?
Eat.
Hi, this is Dave. I'm reporting back.
Drink and busy themselves with the continuation of the species.
Oh, all right. Can you hear the where I'm
he
playing a clip?
The first thing that would happen
okay.
under circumstances
like that... Let me put
like
you on hold, okay? Just
be
patient.
Sure. Human beings would go
sure.
mad and break
sure.
the system, smash it, just so that something unexpected and crazy could happen. Because human beings don't want utopian comfort and certainty. They want adventure and chaos and uncertainty. And so that the very notion of a utopia was anti-human because we're not built for static utopia. We're built for a dynamic situation where there's demands placed on us and where there's the optimal amount of uncertainty. Well, we know what happened in the 20th century as a consequence of the widespread promulgation of utopian schemes. And what happened was mayhem on a scale that had never been matched in the entire history of humanity. And that's really saying something because there was plenty of mayhem before the 20th century. I guess there wasn't as much industrial clout behind it. And so early, you see... So early in the biblical narrative, you have a warning against hubris and some indication that properly functioning systems have an appropriate scale. I read an article in The Economist magazine this week about the rise of nationalist movements all over the world as a counterbalance to globalization. Maybe it's most marked with the European Economic Community. And The Economist writers were curious about why that counter movement has been developing, but it seems to me that it's also a Tower of Babel phenomena, is that, and maybe this is most evident in the European Economic Community, to bring all of that multiplicity under the, what would you call it, under the umbrella of a single unity is to simultaneously erect a system where the top is so far from the bottom that the bottom has no connection to the top. You know, your social systems have to be large enough so they protect you, but small enough so that you have a place in them. And it seems to me perhaps that's what's happened in places like the EEC, is that the distance between the typical citizen and the bureaucracy that runs the entire structure has got so great that it's an element of destabilization in and of itself. And so people revert back to, say, nationalistic identities because it's something that they can relate to. there's a history there and a shared identity, a genuine identity, an identity of language and tradition. It's not an artificial imposition from the top, an artificial abstract imposition. In the Egyptian creation myth, the version I'm most familiar with, in the previous...
Well, let's take a little break here, and we do have a call. We'll come back and talk to that person, Dave, about the Sharia statements at the mosque. 743, Kelly O'Connell got some weather for you. And we've got Dave here. And Dave, you wanted to tell us about your experience at the mosque talking about Sharia law. What happened?
Yes, Kelly. Well, when I went there, it was I was very well received. The people were very accommodating. There was food, refreshments, and it wasn't like I was giving a lecture. I was in a group of about 20 people, a mix of Muslim and non-Muslim, some converts, some born over in the Middle East. And it took a while just to get to the point where they told me that Sharia just means, the word means the way, a direction. And it's not about atrocities that I've heard about. We went back and forth trying to really establish whether they were beating around the bush, as from what I felt. And I point blank said, do you believe in female genital mutilation? And they just about all screamed at me and said, no. And I said, okay, then. I didn't understand. And then absolutely they were against terrorism. So it's like, okay, you folks got to get this word out. Well, they said, now listen, try to equate the different sects of religion in the Middle East with Christian communities in the United States. So, and I got to thinking, okay, you got Baptists, Catholics, you've got Mormons, you've got all this. Well, they said, that's about what it's like over there. And they said, and the one fellow that's from Palestine, he said, I'm not going to say that this stuff does not occur, because it does. But he said, imagine there's a Christian community in the United States and it's the KKK. He said, it's very rare. But he said, do you spend your time on a crusade speaking out against the atrocities of the KKK when it's very limited in number? I said, okay, I get your point. But basically, they're very good people. They're very accommodating. And they do not believe in the atrocities that have been equated to Sharia law. But really, it's a misinterpretation of the word and the practice. So, and I would say to engage any Muslim people that you could at any time just to learn more about them. But I told them that I am fearful, because I know my people here in the United States, if they don't understand, they could lash out and attack Muslim people, thinking that everybody's a terrorist and everybody that looks like a Muslim commits these atrocities.
Well, I mean, so it sounds to me like you went there to give this speech, and during the speech or after the speech, they basically explained to you you were very mistaken.
Correct. Correct.
Is it possible? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's not a big deal to them about what's going on, but I did feel the frustration that they were being accused of such support for atrocities. And I said, well, you have to let people know. And there was a discussion whether or not the word should come from the Muslim community or the American community to say that all Muslim people are not terrorists, are not, do not practice these atrocities on young women. So it was an understanding, and yet I still fear for the Muslim community that are misjudged by some of the, what would you say, not violent, but fearful, angry American citizens that feel as though we're being overrun by Muslims.
All right, Dave, do you think that it's possible that they were not being upfront with you?
It's possible, but I doubt it.
Why?
I felt the sincerity. I felt the frustration then as much as I felt the frustration in myself because of miscommunication.
But how do you know? I mean, why would they, what would they be benefited by getting up and saying we actually agree with all this? How would that possibly turn into a fruitful discussion?
if there was a movement of Muslim and non-Muslim people to get the word out that they are against terrorism and against the atrocities of what we
Dave, we do have another call here, but hold on. Let me put you on hold and get their point, and I'll come back. All right?
Sure, absolutely.
Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Thomas.
Hey, Thomas, can you make your point, and then we'll get off and go back to Dave?
Sure. I just wanted to say with regard to his comments, I think there is some misunderstanding. However, the comparison to the myriad of denominations in Christianity, for example, every time the KKK does something stupid or irrational or violent, the rest of the Christian community does condemn it vehemently, loudly, and systematically. And I think one of the missing elements in America is the Muslim community standing up each and every time and loudly decrying these acts of violence.
All right. Okay. Thanks. All right. So I don't know if you heard that over the air, but basically, well, here's the thing. I mean, how do you know you weren't had? Because when you came on before, you were, you know, you were really adamant and you had your position, and it seems like you walked in there and were really, you know, really persuaded. But I'm wondering is if maybe the persuasion was about you being trying to be nice and understanding, and ultimately you got rolled, as they say.
It could have been. It could be. But at least even going into that conversation, I said to myself, and I was told by actually my brother, who is a converted Muslim, he said, you're wasting your time. There's people there that are just going to dismiss you. Be nice to you, but dismiss you. I said, well, okay, that's fine if that's the case, but at least I'll have my say, and at least I'll feel as though I tried to reach across and try to help. So I could have been rolled. I don't know. If I have been, then I feel very sorry for the Muslim community because they're not taking what I perceive as a big threat. They're not taking it serious.
Well, how do you know?
I don't know.
How do you know that they don't support that? I mean, what would they have to gain by saying, well, actually, we do think that, you know, people should be blown up sometimes, and we do think that female genital mutilation is part of this broader view that Allah has, where these women should not be able to go and have affairs and stuff. They've got an explanation for everything that they do. I just find I am somewhat surprised that you were so adamant and had your points lined up, and then it just seems like you presented your ideas and they said, oh, come on, get serious. Nobody believes that. Please. I mean, of course we're opposed to this and that. And they've done studies and found a large number of Muslims internationally do support Sharia and jihad.
Well, I even brought the word up about jihad, and there was one lady there that was
We've got to hurry here. You know that we're almost out of time, right?
Okay, yeah. I got a sense that the people were sincere, but they don't take the threat to them serious.
Well, I mean, but what would you have to go off of? I would suggest you go study the term or look it up. I'm sure you've heard it before, taqiyya, which means that you agree with your opponent as long as it benefits you. Dave, I got to go. Any last thoughts?
No, just thanks for putting me on the air, and I would say engage any Muslim person you can and just talk to them.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, folks, we'll take one last break here. I am skeptical, 523-1450. I did spend a number of years studying Sharia and writing about it, a few articles, and I'm very skeptical of that report.
With you, you were light and breezy, and I knew just what to do. Now you look so unhappy, and I feel like a fool.
All right, Schiff's Riffs here, mothers and wives.
Hi there, this is Mark Schiff for Schiff's Riffs, and today we're going to talk about marriage. Marriage, the M word. I've been married over 22 years, so I know a little about this. Now, they say men marry their mother. Not true. I did not marry my mother. My wife does not hang up girdles in the bathroom for 6 weeks to dry. It just isn't done. When I was a kid, though, these girdles used to scare the hell out of me. I would see them. I thought they were like a straitjacket for your backside. And the few times I tried them on, I never quite even understood what they were about with all the hooks and the clamps and the straps and the rubber. Who knew? I knew nothing. But that's not what we want to talk about today. One of the differences, a big difference between my wife and my mother is my mother did not even understand me. I lived with her for 18 years. She didn't think I was funny. She would say to Mark, that's not funny. What makes you think that's funny? Do you really think that that's funny? You don't see me laughing, do you? Why don't we call the whole family in here and see if they think it's funny? Maybe your idiot friends think it's funny, but I don't. Now, my wife, on the other hand, thinks I'm a genius. She thinks I'm so bright. People will say to my wife, they'll ask her a question. She'll say, don't ask me, ask Mark. He knows everything. Sometimes I'll take a walk with her and say, why do I bother even talking to you since you already know everything about everything? She's actually said to me, is there anything you don't know? What can I tell you? Even with her cooking, if I make a little suggestion to her about, she's putting a little more salt in the soup, she'll say, you're a great cook. Why don't you cook from now on? And I'll just eat. All right, since you know everything about everything, you know everything about cooking, you know everything about movies, you know everything about people, why don't you just take over? Why don't you pay all the bills from now on? I'll just sit and watch TV and drink beer. The truth is, the only thing that really in this world, the only thing that really understands me more than anything else in the world is my dog. My dog loves me unconditionally, never questions me, always wants to be with me, thinks I'm the best cook, thinks I'm the funniest person that ever existed. Everywhere I go, he wants to go with me. Maybe I should have married my dog. Mark Schiff for Schiff's Riffs.
All right, folks. Well, maybe we can talk about Islam tomorrow, Sharia law. 7:59. If you're Muslim, feel free to call in tomorrow, 523-1450. Have a great day, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. Beware the rain. We'll be back in 22 hours. Ciao.